Sure. So I'm Janet Mee. I'm currently the Interim Managing Director of Student Affairs, but I've spent most of my career at UBC working in the Center for Accessibility. So I've been both an advisor in the early days in the 1990s, and then went on to be the director of what is the now the Center for Accessibility. I can let you know that I've worked in the field of post-secondary education and disability and human rights for the last close to 30 years. First at Capilano College, and then at UBC, where I have now been for close to 27 years, actually. Really have a focus both on ensuring that the university meets its duty to accommodate under the BC Human Rights Code, but also that UBC strives to be an accessible and inclusive place for all people with disabilities, and that we go beyond what's required legally in order to meet those obligations under the code.
That's impressive. I was looking at your LinkedIn, and it goes all the way back to a school in Bella Coola.
Yes.
And I looked at the school, and it sounds like such a unique and accommodating place for learning. Like it's not your standard public school that you would have in the Lower Mainland. And I was just kind of curious, all of your work has been disability related. Can you tell us how you got into this and what really drives you?
Sure. So it's interesting, actually. I forgot that was on my LinkedIn profile. My first teaching job was probably one of the most unique and rewarding experiences that I could have ever imagined, and one really that just came by happenstance. So not something that I had planned to do, and not something that I sort of ever imagined would be a part of an opportunity for me. So when I graduated from university, my plans were to be an elementary teacher. I graduated at a time when there were no jobs for teachers in BC. The market was absolutely dry. There were very few opportunities. Most teacher candidates that were graduating went on to do on-call work for a long period of time before they ever had an opportunity to actually teach in a classroom. All of the practicums that I had done in my later years, so the degree was a very different kind of degree in those days. You did 4 years of education. I had done practicums all in central BC in small communities, and had loved that experience, but had grown up in Vancouver, so I was used to the city. I was approached by Excelsta School. So I had a colleague who had also graduated from UBC who was teaching at the school, had put my name forward as somebody who might be willing to move to a small community. I interviewed by phone. So I never flew to the community in order to interview for the job. I did a phone interview. They offered me the position, I packed up my apartment and I flew to Bella Coola on a very small plane about 2 weeks later.
Wow, fast.
And never looked back. It was the school was a house at the time. I taught my first year in the basement and my second year in the living room.
Oh my.
I had a class that I stuck with for a couple of years. So very small class of students who at the time I learned had quite significant learning disabilities and other forms of disability that were impacting their learning. And we learned together really over a period of 2 years. I think I can say both personally and professionally, that job really framed, I think, who I am as a professional and also who I am as a friend and a colleague and a family member. It's just an extraordinary experience to live in a community of 800 people, to know everyone, and for them to know you. And you blur those lines between your career and your personal life. There's no way to separate them in a community like that. And so I formed community and really learned to work with colleagues in a very collaborative way in order to achieve the outcomes that you're striving for. I mean, we just didn't have the resources, right? A small school like that doesn't have the kind of resources that a large public school would have, or didn't at the time. And so you had to be really creative and clever about how you did things. And I had, even at the time, my mother buying things in Vancouver and shipping them up to me so that I could offer different kinds of opportunities for the kids that were in my class. So I stayed there for 2 years. And when I came home, there were still very few jobs for teachers. And I ended up working for a consultant that did learning disability assessments and programming for adults and children who had learning disabilities and other sort of neurological disabilities. Was their only employee.
Employee.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It was a team of two psychologists that did the assessments, and I was their only employee.
Wow.
So we were a company of three. And they offered me all kinds of opportunities to work with government grants that supported particularly adults with learning disabilities who were experiencing significant barriers to working and pursuing education. And that opportunity enabled me to apply for a job at Capilano College. So that's how I ended up at CAP. Really, if you were to ask me from a career development perspective, how I've ended up where I am, it is purely by chance. So just following one opportunity after another in order, and loving the work in order to kind of explore what possibilities they were. I didn't, at the time, when I first started working at Capilano College, this notion of student affairs as a profession was just not something that even for educators was ever on the table. It wasn't really known as a profession. Like in 1993, when I started at UBC, that was the first time that there were official supports for students with disabilities. Prior to that, there was a counselor in counseling services who used to kind of arrange accommodations in a really informal way.
Wow.
So I came into the profession at a time when this sort of notion of disability advisor was just developing. During my time at UBC, I worked as an advisor supporting students with disabilities and also doing a lot of sort of programming and educational development. I think it was in about 94 or 95 maybe, became the acting director of the Disability Resource Center and eventually the director, and have never really looked back.
That's really insightful. And yeah, that answers a lot of our questions, actually.
It's really about taking a chance, right? Like I think there were lots of times when I wasn't really sure that the next decision I was making about my career was the right one. But you just take the risk and hope there's a safety net. And
yeah. And sorry, what was the name of the school? The
elementary Solsta.
Solsta.
Axelsta. Yeah.
And it's still up and running. Like, the website is beautiful.
It is. So the year after I left, they moved into a brand new, beautiful school that was just outside of Bella Coola. And still in Villa Coola proper, but not in the town. And they're thriving. They're doing amazing work, and the community the school community has really grown. I'd love to go back, actually.
Yeah, you should. And I'm sure they would love, we'll mention them in our show, and it'd be so cool because a school, a house that's where they taught, it's such a interesting environment. I can't imagine. Yeah,
very unique. And within that the house and there was a portable on the school was K to seven, right? So there was all of the kids were really within that one sort of house community, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
We had a kitchen, we cooked.
Oh wow.
Made breakfast together.
We need more of that.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. It made me at certain times in my career where people have been very formal, or even in Vancouver, you know, I think it's a cliche to say that you phone your friends and you make arrangements to do something 3 weeks from now. In a small community, it's the opposite, right? Like people are driving home. They see your cars in the driveway. They stop in. They end up staying for dinner.
It's spontaneous.
It's very spontaneous, very different. And I still to this day, I long for that when I don't have it, and seek it out among my friends and my family.
Yeah, so we're just gonna switch gears a bit, but yes, thank you for sharing all that. It's gonna come up again actually, but yeah. What kind of work is just like in general terms done at the Center of Accessibility?
So at the Center for Accessibility, they're really three types of work, I would say. One is the work that's done one-on-one to support students with disabilities who are studying in all of the range of programs across the university. So that work is really tied to policy LR7, which is the disability policy, and is grounded in the BC Human Rights Code. So, you know, where a student with a disability faces a barrier, an environmental barrier, whether it's a learning barrier or it's a physical barrier, the university has an obligation to ensure that accommodations are in place to address that barrier. And the advisors work with over 4,000 students who are registered with the center to put accommodations in place that enable students to demonstrate their full capacity as a student and to participate in everything that the university has to offer. So that's one piece of work, that one-on-one work with students with disabilities. The second, which is an area that I think we're growing and evolving in, is the how we ensure that that all of our programs and our services are accessible to students with disabilities, and that students with disabilities have what they need in terms of personal capacities or personal skills to be able to participate in those activities. So that looks like things like tutoring programs, mentoring programs for students with autism, that help them to develop skills that will ensure that as students graduate and they go out into the world, or as they're participating at UBC, that they have the mentorship or the skill development that they need to be able to achieve what they're striving to achieve. So that kind of capacity development is a second piece. The third is leadership around accessibility. So, you know, while it is important to ensure that accommodations are in place and that we address the needs of individuals, it's also really important to be looking at the full environment of the university, at the systemic barriers that people with disabilities face, and to address those in a very intentional way. So things like looking at the built environment and looking at the standards for development of new builds or for retrofits to existing buildings. You know, are the standards that we are applying better than the BC Building Code, right? Are we striving for universal accessibility as we build a new building? And a part of that has been looking at things like the Rick Hansen Foundation building standard. So there's a kind of a new standard that is being piloted in the community. And UBC has begun to use that standard, which goes well beyond the BC Building Code, in the design of all of our new buildings. So the new rec center that's going up, Brock Commons, the Gateway building where the student health and well-being and kinesiology will be, and UBC Health, the new bioengineering building. So that's like those kinds of activities, things like admissions practices or policies that govern who gets to be in a honors program. So looking at those policies, asking ourselves the systemic question about the kinds of barriers that may be intentionally or unintentionally built into those policies, and then changing those policies so that people with disabilities have full access. So that bigger systemic piece is, I would say, the third component of the work for the Center for Accessibility.
I was just saying that I'm so happy to hear that the Center of Accessibility does so much work in that capacity in all those three areas, because, you know, as a person with a disability, it feels like it's addressing one thing when you're a student, or when you hear, like, I have my friends that, you know, go into teaching and they have disabilities. There's that part, you know, doing the job. But then there's also, like you say, a systemic issue that feels so big and large scale and hard to kind of grapple and fight, you know, and yes. You don't want to fight your whole life sometimes. And it's actually very, very reassuring and encouraging to hear that Center of Accessibility is taking that on, because you got to start somewhere, and to be an example for the rest of society is such a big deal. So I thank you guys for doing that. And we do want to talk about a lot more about those three categories that Center, you know, focuses on. I think there's a lot that we want to talk about, actually. I think we'll start with, let's just start with the name of the Center of Accessibility, and then we'll go into more about the details of what the program does. Because I remember the Disability Resource Center as being like the name for all the places when you go to university. And it was always so, I remember like saying that to a classmate or whatever, and I'd be like, whoa, disability, like what is, like, it felt a little bit dramatic, but you know, it is what it is as well. It was a resource. And then I remember seeing the name now, then after that it became Access and Diversity. And now it's the Center of Accessibility. So can you tell us a little bit about how the name evolved, why it did, how did it evolve, and maybe explain to some of our listeners, like, why does language play such a big role in the title?
It's a fascinating question. So in the early days, when the center was first formed, we were referred to as a disability resource center. And those words were quite carefully chosen. So there's lots of politics around the term disability. You know, for some folks, there's the whole notion of disability first language versus person first language. It relates a lot to identity. There is certainly, I think, in all aspects of life, but particularly in this field, no one answer, no one identity, no one name for our unit that will resonate with everyone, that will necessarily would necessarily be their first choice. But one of the things that we found about the term disability in our title is that not all students who would require accommodations or support identify as being a person with a disability. So disability is also a very cultural term. In some language, in some cultures, there is no equivalent to the sort of North American concept of disability. We have a high population of international students. And so we found over time that there were many students who would say to us in third or fourth year, I never felt like I could come to that office, or, you know, I didn't realize that I met the definition of the sort of North American mm-hmm. definition of disability. Yeah. And so as much as there are many folks who identify very proudly as being a person with a disability and have a cultural affinity to that identity, there are also lots of folks who don't. So that was one reason that we ended up sort of switching from disability to a notion of accessibility. 2003, I think, the Disability Resource Center was combined with what was the Women's Students Office at the time.
Oh, okay.
Into a broader social justice unit that addressed issues of racism, homophobia, sexism, ableism. So it was a sort of a larger unit. And so that's where the term access and diversity came from, because it was around accessibility and access to education, but also around other forms of identity and accessibility. And we remained that unit doing both the Disability Resource Center work that we had always done and the larger social justice work for about 12 years, I think. So we continued to do the leadership work around accessibility, but we also developed something called the Really Campaign, which was an active bystander campaign, the original community building education that student leaders do as a part of orientation and other activities was designed by staff in the Center for in Access and Diversity. And then in 2015, the university is a constantly evolving place, and you'll probably notice that our organizational structure changes fairly regularly in order to structure ourselves in a way that will best meet the current need. And so a lot of the social justice work that we had been doing around race, around gender, and around LGBTQ communities moved back to the Equity and Inclusion Office. And we refocused our energy on accessibility for people with disabilities. And that's when we became the Center for Accessibility.
Gotcha.
And at that time, we thought long and hard about what the name of the unit would make sense. We specifically chose Center because we wanted to signal that we were not only a resource for students, but a hub for leadership on accessibility across campus. And that while we supported students with disabilities specifically, that the larger systemic work that we did was directed at all individuals with disabilities, whether they were a permanent member of our community or they were a visitor to UBC. And so Center was meant to signify that notion of a hub. And we specifically chose accessibility over disability because we felt that the term accessibility encompassed our aspiration as opposed to the community that we were working with and for. And that it helped us to address that notion of access to the resources that we had to offer, because by removing the name disability from our unit name, we eliminated that first barrier to actually walking in our door, because students don't necessarily have to identify culturally as a person with a disability to access the resources that we have. If you have an ongoing medical condition that has an impact on your ability to function, we hope that you will see yourself in the description of our unit without seeing the name of the unit as a barrier to accessing those resources. So that's how we ended up with the Center for Accessibility.
Yeah, I didn't know there was such a complex history, but yeah.
Big deal what name you call yourself, you know?
It is actually, yeah. You know, you don't think about it, right? You just think that people will find you no matter what, but in fact, we do students, particularly, I think, around the notion of accessibility and the identity of disability, students think long and hard about whether they're prepared to out themselves as a person with a disability. You know, there's still lots of stigma. And we want to be sure that we're seen as the most sort of open and approachable unit as possible in order to ensure that anybody who needs us finds us.
Yeah, I think you brought up just now about the Western standard that some students think they don't qualify for to register in the center, and I was just got me thinking about how a lot of us in UBC just come from cultures that still have even bigger stigma.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm glad that was brought up, but yeah, I just was thinking about that. Speaking of, oh, sorry.
No, I was going to say it continues to be a huge issue, right? Even the new title for the unit and the work that we do with international student development, we still know that there are probably students who are worried about approaching the Center for Accessibility or worried about confidentiality, right? About who will know if they're accessing the resources of the center. It continues to be a challenge for us.
Yeah.
Speaking of just the students, like, do you have an idea of like how many UBC faculty and students with disabilities or accessibility, like accommodations the center works with?
Yeah, you guys cover faculty,
close to 4,000.
Right?
Yeah.
5,000 now.
Yeah, 4,000.
4,000, okay.
And they are in every faculty and school across the campus. And at every level. So we've got, you know, lots of students at the undergraduate level, but also lots of students in master's and PhD programs, and in both very academic sort of pursuits, and also in all of the professional programs.
That's a lot of unique cases to deal with, because not every disability is the same. Me having hearing loss doesn't mean like the next person beside me who has hearing loss requires the same needs or communicates the same way.
Exactly.
And it takes a lot of understanding and different accommodations to really properly address people's needs. And, you know, it's not just the student, it's also their learning environment, the teacher, the living environment as well. So, and maybe some of you have a hard time kind of grappling like what that looks like and what work maybe the Center of Accessibility does. Can you maybe give us an example of like how the center has helped support, you know, even UBC faculty or students who have what is a complex case and having to work with their disability? Can you help us kind of paint the picture of what that might look like, or just an example, like, you know, how complex or what kind of things that you guys do?
I can give that a try. So so I would say it's very hard to say that one field or one kind of disability can be more complex than others, because it is the unique nature of the circumstances that students bring with them. And not only their identity as a person with a disability, but other intersections. So are they an Indigenous student? Are they a single parent? Are they a first generation college or university student? How long have they lived in Canada? Did they study in the K-12 system in Canada, or did they have they moved to Vancouver to study as a university student and maybe are not familiar with the education system? So disability is one facet of the interaction that a student would have with the Center for Accessibility, but we're very careful to pay attention to all of those other identities that have an impact on students' learning and on even how they have adapted to the functional impacts of their disability. So the first step in any process is to understand the personal circumstances, and not in a counseling sense, but in a, what do we need to know? What's relevant to a decision about your learning and your circumstances that would be important to share with an accessibility advisor? And so there's a first conversation that is about the impact of disability, the kinds of accommodations a student might have received in the past, if they received accommodations in the K-12 system or at another post-secondary institution. We look at the field of study. So what are you planning to study? What does that look like? Is it a program, an undergraduate program with a significant lab or practical component? Or is there going to be a lot of research and essay writing and other kinds of activities? So what is the nature of the academic learning and activity that will take place? And are there other aspects of your identity or your life experience that will have an impact on how you might respond to accommodations or what kind of accessibility needs we need to address. So one of the things I would say is that over time, the types of disabilities that that students present with has really changed. So when I first started, and I make myself sound really old, but I have been doing this for a long time. When I first started at UBC, there were maybe 250 to 270 students with disabilities who identified as requiring accommodations at UBC. So, you know, the number of students was still pretty significant, but the number of students with disabilities was very small. And the students who tended to come forward were people who you might think of as having those kind of more traditional types of disabilities, right? The things that people think about when they think about disability. So people who used a wheelchair, people who couldn't walk long distances, people who are blind or visually impaired, or people who had hearing loss. That was sort of the full population of people of students with disabilities that were coming forward. We had very few students, if any, who identified as having a learning disability or a neurological disability, or were neurodiverse in any way. And we had very few students who identified as having a mental illness or a mental health condition that would require accommodation. Today, I think it's over 50%, 55% of the students who seek accommodations through the Center for Accessibility identify mental health as the primary reason for seeking accommodation. And many times that mental health condition is comorbid with another disability, like a learning disability or chronic pain. So very often, right, we would see students who have a primary diagnosis of chronic pain that may have resulted from an accident or a degenerative medical condition, but then they're also experiencing depression or high levels of anxiety that are like a secondary impact of the chronic pain. And so figuring out the combination of accommodations that will work for somebody who is not just sort of straightforward, right? It's not just one disability or one medical condition. It's often more than one that are impacting a student's learning in more than one way. So that's one component, is how do we address the disability? The second is, what will the student be studying? So we have lots of students who are studying in UBC health programs, for example, where they have classroom accommodations. So they've got in the traditional academic component of the program, they have labs, they have practical exams, they have traditional written exams, they have lectures, they have group work. They have problem-based learning in classrooms. In the last 2 years, we've thrown on top of that the online environment and all of the impacts that has had in terms of the design of the learning environment. So we put a set of accommodations in place for those traditional academic activities, but then there's often a practical component. So for teaching, for all of the UBC health programs, through many internships and other programs, students are out in the community doing work that will be very similar to the work that they do once they graduate, but they're doing it in a learning capacity, and they require accommodations in that environment as well. So in that case, it's a matter of working sometimes with the community member that will be hosting the student, the program itself, and the Center for Accessibility to figure out which accommodations need to be in place in a practical setting, which means then understanding the work itself, right? And what does an intern or a doctor have to be able to do in a clinical setting, in a community-based medical practice, versus what would they have to be able to do in a community setting, in a hospital.
Yeah.
And so it's a very iterative process, right? There isn't one set of accommodations that we establish at the beginning of a student's degree and they just stick with it. Very often as a student hones in on the final degree that they're seeking, what their major will be, it requires a constant kind of revisit of those accommodations in order to make it work. The last thing I would say is it's very much a problem solving kind of process, right? There is no formula that we use to determine what accommodations might work. Nicole, you mentioned sort of early on that, you know, what works for one student with hearing loss won't necessarily work for the next student with hearing loss. That's true for every form of disability. And it means that it's a conversation back and forth until we land on the set of accommodations that will work for that individual student. The only other thing I didn't sort of mention in that process is that very often instructors help us to figure things out, right? So a student and an accessibility advisor might identify four or five options for accommodation in a classroom setting, and where it's not clear what the best option would be, then we often involve the instructor also in a conversation to help us identify the accommodation that will make the most sense for that classroom.
Makes me have like a million questions, because the whole thing is just, I think I've been in school for 8-9 years, and I've gone through a lot of disability resource centers to work out accommodations like that. And I've taken like classes exactly like you mentioned, labs and clinicals. And clinical for me as a nurse is going to the hospital site and, you know, kind of taking on like the skill, the in-person skill, and, you know, talking to patients and doctors, that people who don't know you.
Yes.
And as a young person, and I'm sure as any, you know, not even just a young person, as a person trying to figure out what they want to do in their life and going to school in order to figure out what that is and have a disability, yes, where you're kind of like paving the path for yourself and maybe for others of how you're going to be successful in your studies and in your field of interest when you haven't done the job before.
I know.
Like, how do I know how to make my hearing loss work? That is also not, in my opinion, going to be too much from asking from someone else. And not too disruptive. I mean, I don't ever want to be an inconvenience, but how do you find those answers? And like I said, you know, going through that system for so many years, it's exhausting. And I can totally see what you're saying with how sometimes you can have mental illness on top of it that develops secondary, because for me personally, I didn't realize I had anxiety and depression for years. I just called it stress, you know, just stress of like having to go to class and make yourself known and having to be like professional when I was like having an off day or studying late for an exam, or, you know, it's very anxiety ridden. And also having, you know, nursing school tell me that they didn't think that I could be a nurse. And just, it just kind of shakes your world. And so much happens as a student to put yourself out there. It's not just, you know, I don't know if a lot of listeners know about the process for getting enrolled into the program. It's not like you just walk in and make an appointment. There's discussions like we talk about. There's a lot of planning, I think, that happens. And it takes time. And I think for me personally, that would sometimes also cause me to have anxiety, because will I enroll? Like, so there was feedback, should I take the full course load? And I wanted to, but is it appropriate? And I was like, what? Am I being seen as like less than for being offered to take?
Yeah.
You know, so there's just so much that happens from both the student and the instructor side. I think Jesse had a question, but I just wanted to like fully appreciate, you know, how challenging and how many layers and how the process of being a person with a disability in general just has so much to not just address, but just acknowledge.
Yes.
And come together and collaborate, because you know what, there's not always any even solution. There wasn't a solution for hearing with a stethoscope. Like I had to look for an electronic stethoscope that was for the Ebola crisis, not for people who were hard of hearing. So there's that's just an example for like listeners to like realize, you know, that, and I guess employers out there as well, like they're just isn't always an answer by Googling it. They're like, you just kind of have to look around and figure it out.
You do. And I, you know, and I think, I mean, one of the pieces that I think that we have come a long way in terms of our accessibility as a society and as a community and in addressing stigma, but there's still a long, long way to go. And it's very dependent on, particularly within employment, the profession. So, you know, there is still like in all healthcare professions, we know that there's still stigma. There's still an assumption that if you have a certain type of disability, that you're not going to be able to function in certain kinds of environments. And in those programs where you're, so much of the learning is dependent on the relationship that the university has with communities who are inviting students into those fields. We also have an obligation to be educating those employers, right? Because they're a part of the student experience. And unfortunately, I'm sure it won't be the last time I hear of somebody who has suggested to an individual with a disability that that's not the right profession for them. There's no such thing. Right, there's a way around almost all barriers, and there's so much diversity within any profession. Right, like if one employment site isn't the right site, there's 500 more. I do think sometimes that there's a particular expectation that people with disabilities will think they're through their career differently than anyone else. And I've never understood that, right? Like people should pursue their passion first and we'll figure out the rest later.
It like totally hits home for me. I'm like trying not to cry, but yeah. Thank you for like saying that. That like really validates and like, you know, just give me like a breath of fresh air to like, just like, you know, you've been doing the right thing. Like, you know, there's a way, so.
There is always a way. And we're focused right now. We have a whole project underway with the UBC health programs to really look at increasing the number of students with disabilities in those programs and addressing the barriers that they're facing. So a number of our advisors are working with those professional schools to really create an environment that will allow or invite people with disabilities to thrive in those professions.
Oh yeah, so Janet, you think you probably anticipated this question about a resume to in-person classes and how your online systems have been like put in place due to COVID, such as online accommodation letters. How has been that process when it comes to just adhering to the in-person format again, or just like going or having both at the same time?
So, oh my goodness, what a shift we made. So we had a couple of things going for us, I think, as we entered into the pandemic. And some was just by happenstance. One was that we actually don't have enough space. Like the space that we're in right now, we have grown. The university has provided more and more resources to the Center for Accessibility in order to ensure that we can do the best possible, provide the best possible support for students with disabilities. And so our numbers of advisors have really grown over time, the numbers of exam staff that we have, and also the number of administrative staff that are supporting programs has grown. In anticipation of the construction of the Brock Commons project, which is where we will move in a few years, we lost some of our space, right? So Crane Library and the spaces in the annex were demolished as in order to make way for the new construction. And so we were already working in a hybrid environment. Our advisors were working one day a week from home, and we were all set up to do that. They had laptop computers that were ready. We had already been hosting meetings by phone and by Zoom and by other things. And so unlike many other units that had to adapt right away, we were all set. And so from that perspective, to move from in-person appointments for students to online appointments was a pretty seamless process. Adapting the accommodations for students from the in-person environment to online was incredibly complex. So students who faced minimal barriers in an in-person environment were facing significant barriers in the online environment. We saw a significant increase in the number of students who had hearing loss and vision loss who came forward to say that they now needed to identify as a person with who required accommodations but hadn't needed it in the in-person environment. A part of that was the kind of technology that both the instructors had and that students had. So often students were experiencing a delay, like if they relied on lip reading, they were experiencing a delay between the video and the audio in the online lecture. And they required captioning in order to be able to follow the lecture because they could no longer rely on lip reading to be able to follow the class. There were all kinds of issues for people with low vision around being able to follow course materials that were on a share screen, for example. And so we had to revisit in a significant number of cases, the accommodations that students were eligible for and redo that whole set of accommodations to adapt to the online environment. And we had to do a fair amount of training with instructors to help them understand what new barriers students were facing in that online environment. And then we had to rethink the whole piece around exams.
Oh, yeah.
Which was terribly complex. So the first thing we tried was to have instructors themselves adapting the time allowances. So if somebody had extended time, that the instructor adapted that in the whatever platform they were using. Oh.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh.
155.
Okay.
Okay,
we all got.
You know what is so funny? I like this morning on the radio on CBC, they told us 500 times that was going to happen.
I was just going to say that. I knew it was coming, but I didn't know when. Obviously, no. I guess. Okay. Oh my god! I thought like, and I'm plugged into my hearing aid, so it was, I don't know about you, but it was like super loud.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was like from the call or like me, but it was.
All three of us. We got it stereo.
Oh well.
Now okay. Now I can't even remember what I was saying.
The exams or?
Oh, exams.
Yeah.
But one of the principles that I live by, and I think we live by as a center, is that we want to make it as easy for people to do the right thing as possible, as easy as possible for people to do the right thing. And so we shifted pretty quickly from having instructors adapting the exams themselves in the online environment to going back to a model where the exam staff and the invigilators in the Center for Accessibility did that work for instructors. Huh. And so even though the exams were mostly online, our exam coordinators still set up the accommodations, they made the adaptations to the online environment, they did everything for the instructor so that the exam was just ready to go at the time that the exam started. And in many cases, we invigilated the exam. So where a student had an accommodation that they might have not wanted to share, or for an instructor to know about. So for example, we have lots of students who for a whole variety of reasons have the ability to take breaks during their exams. So for a student who has Crohn's disease, that might be because they need access to a washroom regularly during the exam, and they don't really want to have to tell their instructor where they're going. And so typically they would write with the Center for Accessibility, and we know, and nobody else knows and shouldn't care. But in the online environment, even if an instructor is invigilating that exam, then the question comes up of why are you leaving the screen so often, right? So we invigilated those exams for the instructor so that the student could have the same privacy that they have when they write with the Center for Accessibility. There's lots of students who have rituals that they or strategies that they use during an exam to stay calm. Or if they've got obsessive compulsive disorder, they might have rituals that they just naturally follow, you know, during the course of an exam that they wouldn't necessarily want anybody else to observe or to have to answer questions on. So we continue to do some of those exams for students who have those kinds of accommodations. And now what we're seeing is a combination. So some classes have gone back to in-person exams, and we're doing the very traditional kinds of accommodations that we were doing both in the classroom and in the exam setting. And other instructors have adapted their teaching and their learning environment based on some of the things that were kind of unique and special about the online environment, but gone back to also what functioned well of the in-person environment. And so we're now having to adapt to this huge diversity in the way instructors are designing their classes and adapting their assessments. And it's a steep learning curve for us. Every faculty has some new and unique platform that they're using online. We need to be sure that all of those platforms are accessible, that they work with adaptive technology, that they don't provide barriers for students with like specific types of disabilities. And so it's become a much more complex, again, another layer of a much more complex process than it was when we were just a traditional educational institution. The only other thing I would say about the online versus in-person is that there's a notion out there, I think, that the online environment was better for students with disabilities, that being able to work and study at home was ideal. And for some students, it was, absolutely, right? The online environment, the ability to study from home, to not have to commute to campus, to not be distracted by the others in the learning environment was golden. Yeah. But for many students, it was an isolating and very negative experience, right? So I think one of the things that we're trying to be really conscious of as we move forward is that remote learning, it is not necessarily the panacea that many students put it forward as. It has real drawbacks in terms of community, in terms of the kind of experience that students have in the learning environment. And we're trying to be really cognizant of that as we look at what worked and what we can learn from the last 2 years.
I can imagine, group discussion being a challenge, like for me, trying to hear, and when you have like just 10 minutes of discussion time to do figure out a solution page or something like that and bring it to the rest of the class. Like it's
exactly,
it's just really challenging, online, but it's also challenging in person as well. Yeah. I also wanted to ask, is there something that students can know about the work that the center does in terms of curriculums and programs? Like, is it more individual based? When, let's say, a change is made to the way, say, a program is taught. So let's say, there's different modalities of learning, right? There's different learning styles. So is there background work, meeting with all the program heads or and just kind of reevaluating the curriculum yearly? Or is there studies that come forward and say, we've also gotten feedback from people who also don't have disabilities that, your student could benefit from this? Like, is there something on a bigger scale that sometimes happens, or is it more kind of an individual based and then just those kind of changes?
So it's both. So we do work with the Center for Teaching and Learning, Teaching, Learning and Technology, so CTLT, to look at universal design in the learning environment. So much like there's the concept of universal design in the built environment, there's universal design for learning, which looks at how teaching practices particularly, but educational environments can be adapted so that they're accessible to more people without requiring accommodations. And that's not specific to disability. So that goes also for adapting learning environments to accommodate students for whom English might be their second or third language, or students who are first generation post-secondary learners, or students who have family obligations which make it very difficult to participate in sort of, you know, the extracurricular practical activities. And so we work with CTLT to create projects that look at curriculum and educational design. They take the lead on a lot of that work because they really are working with faculties and instructors, and they have some mechanisms to really incentivize that work. So that happens. It's slower. And right at the moment, I think we're in an interesting place because students and instructors saw the capacity for lots of innovation as we shifted so quickly from in-person to online. Mm-hmm. And we're all exhausted, right? Like, we've been through 2 years of a pandemic. Yeah. People learned, instructors especially, learned to do things that they never anticipated would be part of the requirement of teaching at UBC. And asking them to continue to innovate right in this moment is challenging.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we're trying to be really conscious of that and to make sure that we hold on to the learning, but that we not expect the pace of change to continue in the way that it has over the last 2 years. We just can't sustain that kind of momentum.
Gotcha. Are people with disabilities, are they invited to those conversations? Is it more like reports that are given kind of like afterhand and then brought to the table? Like, I guess, is there some reassurance that, you know, everything about, nothing about it without it kind of philosophy?
So there's a number of ways that happens. One is through collecting information from students who are seeking accommodations constantly. So we're constantly feeding the information that those 4,000 students provide to us back into the system. We do sort of focus groups and different kinds of sort of community activities where students are able to bring forward ideas and sort of formulate solutions. To be honest, we haven't done as much of that in the last couple of years as we were doing. And I think it's really just been because it's been such a scramble to try to just make the basic minimum needs of students over the last couple of years. But we will return to those activities. Also, any committees that we develop, right? So even our search committees when we're hiring new staff, but also as we're looking at new programs, we have students with disabilities on those committees, helping to inform the decisions that we're making.
Yeah, that was actually one of our other questions earlier. Who makes up the Center of Accessibility, and how are advisors selected, and how are they trained, and how do they gain understanding, all of that?
So the center has currently, I know I'm going to get this number wrong, but about 12 advisors. So 12 accessibility advisors. That number has grown significantly over time. They work in a portfolio model. So you both mentioned sort of early on the complexity of the fields of study at UBC, the programs that we offer, the nature of the the disabilities that students present with, or live with. And so we've divided our advisors into two teams that work with clusters of faculty. So one that works with the Faculty of Arts and the Sauder School of Business and Law and the Access Studies programs and non-degree studies programs. And then another that works with Applied Science, the UBC Health programs, Education, although I think we're switching Education to the other portfolio, and Applied Science and Science. And so a part of that is that they can get to know and build relationships with those faculties that will help and sort of smooth that process. Those advisors, in terms of their professions, range widely. So there is no, in our view, no single profession that prepares you to work in a post-secondary environment supporting students with disabilities. So some of our advisors, two of them are lawyers. So they're trained, they have law degrees and they're trained as lawyers. They don't work as lawyers and they bring that lens perhaps to the work, but they're not practicing lawyers when they work with us. Okay. We have several advisors who have a counseling background, many who have a background in higher education. Some like myself who have a background in education, just in teaching, even at the K-12 level. We have social workers working as accessibility advisors. We have occupational therapists working as accessibility advisors. I would say that in addition to the professional expertise that they bring, we're really looking across our team for folks who are respectful, both in their work with students and in their work with their colleagues, are creative. Like, this job is all about solving, you know, 50 unique problems a day. And you have to love that kind of work, and you have to have the right mindset to say, you know, I just need to think this through. I'm going to try in that door. And when that door doesn't work, I'm going to just shift over and I'm going to try a different approach in door number two, to figure out, right, what's going to work. So they each bring professional expertise to the team, and then they each have a unique set of qualities that makes them great at this work, which has nothing to do with education or training. It has everything to do with who they are as human beings. So there's that team. There's a whole team of students and staff. So student employees and ongoing staff who support the exam invigilation process. So there are exam coordinators and a team lead, but there are also a team of like 50 graduate students who invigilate exams for students with disabilities and work with us for a period of time. They are often, actually the exam coordinators, many of them have worked as invigilators while they're doing their degrees, and as a position becomes available, have applied for it. We have others who produce alternate format materials. So quite often they have a background in library science, or in at times even in performance, so in theater or voiceover work, who have worked sort of in broadcasting, who then are really good at producing alternate format materials. So it's a real range. It's a fascinating office to be a part of, because there is no common thread in terms of the background that people bring to the work that they're doing at the center. In terms of training, it's a combination of professional development that comes from connections to professional organizations. So most of the staff at the Center for Accessibility are members of the Canadian Association of College and University Student Services, which is an organization that really promotes professional development and has professional standards for work in all of the fields of student affairs. There's the Association of Higher Education and Disability in the US that helps to inform our work. And there is a long history within the center of practices and approaches that we've developed that we then train our new team members to be able to understand and to facilitate as they do their work. But then every new staff member who comes in informs our new practice, our practice in a new way, challenges the existing practices, pushes us to try something new and different, and things evolve on an annual basis for that reason.
Hey, like, how would you say you stay up to date with like this evolving language and perspectives of the community? And like, how does the center ensure the representation with up to date information and technology, since the topic of like the technology came up?
It's challenging, particularly around technology. So one of the things we try to do, a couple of things. One is to be as knowledgeable as we can about the types of technology that are out there, particularly adaptive technology, in order to help our students and our instructors access the sort of the latest and the greatest of technologies that are available. We rely on a government agency, so there is a specialized team within the provincial government that supports access to technology and other supports for students with disabilities through the Canada Study Grant. So they have tremendous expertise, and we will often work with them directly to identify the right technology for an individual student with a disability. And then we also rely on the people that are purchasing and utilizing that technology to purchase technology or to design their platforms in a way that will be accessible for people with disabilities. And that's about setting a set of principles and saying you must, right, you like, for any technology that you buy, we are encouraging you to, or in some cases we are saying you must ensure that it is can be adapted for certain kinds of adaptive technology, or will allow for captioning on any activity in any platform. And so sometimes it's about setting an expectation for the people who are using that technology and requiring them to make sure that the technology itself is accessible. So on the technology front, it's a combination. In the field itself, it's about staying connected to people across the country and around the world who are doing really innovative work in supporting students with disabilities, about being active members of professional organizations and being really diverse about that. So, you know, currently we have two occupational therapists who are members of the Center for Accessibility team. That's fairly new for us. We hadn't hired, in fact, I don't think we'd had very many people with an occupational therapy background who had applied for the jobs, but they bring tremendous new expertise to the conversation about accessibility, about barrier-free environments, about and particularly about learning environments. And so we learn from each other as we bring new members of our team and as new people explore things. And we do professional development every year. So, you know, a fundamental part expectation is that people are learning all of the time, that we're, you know, we're reading the latest research that has been published when we can. It's tough to keep up. And that we're attending conferences and other kinds of activities to learn from people who are doing new and innovative things.
That's great. That's so great to be as involved and connected as you guys can, because it's so hard to keep up with, you know, not even just the technology, but sometimes even like the language or the cultural attitude sometimes. Yes. Like sometimes it's also, you need to kind of, I guess, like to have lawyers part of your team too, because sometimes you want to change the language, but it's hard to foresee. Like me, it is. Sometimes it's hard to foresee, like, what would happen if we did change language sometimes, because, you know, you never know what it might mean to somebody else, too.
Very much. And it's interesting that you would mention lawyers, because one of the things that I think there's often an assumption that, for example, lawyers who do this work are looking to limit the types of accommodations or the types of supports that would be available to students or to members of the community. And my experience of the lawyers that we work with at UBC and the external lawyers that we look at is that they're also striving to ensure that UBC does the best it can, right? That they're among my favorite people, actually, because they help us to push those boundaries. And you know, they understand the significant ambitions that are embedded in the BC Human Rights Code, and know that and help us to push individuals that maybe don't want to go as far as we need them to go, because they know that, right, that the law will require us to do it, and that it's the right thing to do.
I think I want to ask about living on campus, the people who live on campus with disabilities, and I personally would have loved to have done that, I think, just to be around your peers and, you know, be able to focus so much on your studies or go to lab so easily. Yeah. But I personally was just so daunted by it, because I think maybe growing up thinking that I couldn't be as independent, or that I would have to worry about like my safety, like if I was walking and I couldn't hear someone behind me, or if I was showering and I couldn't hear the smoke alarms, just things like that. And and you did mention about being involved with the other programs on campus and having some systemic roles and trying to make, you know, the environment a bit more accessible. Can you talk about some of the work that has been done? Or you've mentioned also that the new buildings coming up are going to be more accessible. What about campus life, like living in the dorms and stuff?
Sure. So student residences and student housing are a key partner within for the Center for Accessibility, and we work very closely with them, and they strive and are very committed to providing an accessible environment for students with disabilities. So some of the things you've mentioned, so at the outset, they do meet all of the requirements for building accessible units. So we have units that are wheelchair accessible in every residence. We look at the public facilities, so the lobbies and the common areas and those kinds of things, to ensure that they're accessible for people with a range of disabilities. One of the things that's really challenging about the housing environment is we're talking about people's homes. And so the needs, even some of the needs, Nicole, that you've mentioned, are pretty unique to an individual. And it's not possible to put them in every facility or every residence. And so we take an as needed approach to that work. So if we have, for example, a deaf student who requires, or a hard of hearing student who requires particular features in order to be able to be safe and independent in an environment, then they're given they go through a process to either have priority access to housing or priority placement. And when it's a placement, it's about the features of that facility. So we would install, for example, a visual alarm, a visual doorbell, other safety features that somebody who maybe wouldn't be able to hear the auditory alarms, right? Fire alarms, those kinds of things. We ensure that all of those things are adapted in that unit and in the building that the student would live in. If they require particular features in a bathroom in order to be able to stabilize themselves as they transfer from one location to the other, we figure that out on a student-by-student basis, and we make those adaptations to the residence facility. We also do at times priority placement, or priority access. So where a student really for disability related reasons really needs to live on campus. So they can't take public transit, for example, or there isn't accessible public transit from where their family is located to campus. Then we would give them priority access. We would bump them to the front of the line to ensure that they are not relying on the regular process to be eligible to live in housing, or if they are required to go back to their home several times during the day to perform medical procedures, for example, or that they need to rest for extended periods of time during the day as a result of the impact of a disability, then we might provide them with priority access to a residence. So they might not need any specific facility, but they might need other pieces. The other kinds of adaptations we make are also auditory alarms for people who have low vision. We've made adaptations for people who have attendant care, so where they have a 24-hour person who provides personal care, then we make allowances for that. We've installed lifts in residences. We just do, I mean, it's the same process, right? We do whatever it takes based on the individual needs of the student.
So good to hear. Like, I love that. And I had no idea about the priority placements, which is so great to hear, because I remember there was another committee member, part of the All Access Pass, who loved the online experience, but then she also had a, I think, chronic back pain issue, and she also lived really far away, and when it resumed in person, she had to drive there. It just took some planning for her. Yeah. But I think she ended up not getting notified that class was canceled a couple of times, and it's just really exhausting for her. Totally. And I think, you know, if people maybe had like seen it as an option, or like just, you know, that does happen, you know, not maybe not now, but like maybe if something had changed for her in terms of her studies or where she's living, like that kind of just reassuring that accommodations like that can happen, because I always think, you know, accommodations are just academic. So
nope, they're, you know, everything.
It's more than just sitting in class. You need your community too. It's
living, it's co-op, it's recreation, it's right, it's student leadership. We want students with disabilities to be able to participate in all of those aspects of university life.
Yeah, did you mention the something's happening with the rec center?
There's a new rec center that's being built.
Okay. Right now, just in.
Well, it's going to go. I'm going to get it wrong, but it's right outside the Student Life Building.
Oh, so just where the old one is standing now, right?
Nope. It's in addition to.
Oh, okay. So the old one is still going to be. We're just getting another. Okay.
You're getting another one.
Yeah, I was just
curious.
And it's
going to be really accessible.
Okay. Yeah.
That's exciting. When do you think that'll be like completed?
I can't remember when they break ground on it. It's in design now, and there was a design board that was up outside of the Life Building a couple months ago. So I think it will get underway fairly soon.
What changes would you like to see with the center just going forward?
I mean, one of the things in my role as interim managing director, one of the things I'm looking at is the as part of a team is the sort of structure of the portfolio and how we can best meet the ambitions of the student strategic plan and the goals that we have for the student experience. And I think one of the things that I'd love to see more of is more integration of disability and accessibility as a topic of conversation in all of the planning that goes into all of the other experiences. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, accessibility in the learning environment, but there's also accessibility in orientation, and there's accessibility in the work that, or the opportunity to participate in a collegia or to be a part of a student club. And so, I think as we've expanded the number of advisors, one of our ambitions is to really be looking at all of those other aspects of student life that are critical but sometimes ignored by offices who are so focused on the academic environment and ensuring, which is important, of course, that students can function in those environments. We have some new resources, new financial resources that's allowing us to do more work on the systemic barriers. And so I think we're really trying to figure out what structure will work for the center in order to be able to do more of that work. I think over time the center will continue to grow. So, you know, even with the increase in number of advisors, the advisor to student ratio is still not as low as we would like it to be as a leadership team.
Yeah.
And the university is very supportive. Like it's a matter of not a matter of helping them to understand the need. It's really from our perspective, wanting to ensure that we grow in a way that is sustainable and manageable. So, you know, doubling your numbers, for example, of advisors really changes the dynamic, and it makes it very hard to keep work consistent. And so we just want to continue to grow slowly over time so that we learn from, but also incorporate, you know, new staff in a way that maintains the quality of the support that we're providing. So those are the sort of big things. In a few years, we'll be moving into a new physical environment. So we will have a new office in the Brock Commons space. And it will have a new exam center for students with disabilities, which will be exciting, even better than the one we have now. So we're looking forward to some physical changes in our environment as well over the next few years.
We're wondering a bit about student life as well. I've always asked for other hard of hearing students that I could talk to, you know, just about like career, or like learning study methods, and just like every day kind of just sharing experiences. And the feedback I got from four colleges was that they couldn't disclose who those students were because of confidentiality. I think I just wanted a community. I think that's just, I just didn't know that there was someone like me or whatever, but is there something that maybe is going on, like a community or something, like a club or social gathering that others could know about or join in?
So there's a new resource group, a new AMS resource group. It's an interesting issue. I mean, confidentiality it is of course important, and offices like ours can't breach confidentiality, but that doesn't have to stop us from connecting students to one another, right? Because that connection can be voluntary. We've tried a number of different things that haven't worked, around hosting sessions, inviting students to come who have particular interests. But I think as we come out of the pandemic, there might be some new and creative ways to connect students first online and then let them take the next step to connect in person. And so, you know, I think after we take a breath, that there is a tremendous need for that sense of community and to be sharing and learning from folks who have had similar experiences or who have already experienced the thing that you're just contemplating. We'll have to think more about how we help to connect those students.
Oh, and another question I was thinking about as I was reading about the center is, can other UBC programs such as our All Access Pass radio show use the program, the Center of Accessibility, to try to figure out ways to get audio transcripts or maybe more wheelchair accessible ways into the studio, or like dexterity, like accommodation for soundboards and everything? I always thought it was for like students, and I'm a community member, but there are like people within our radio show that have disabilities as well. I'm just kind of curious, like, how would we do it, and how would we approach you guys, and how, I don't know.
So absolutely. I mean, probably many of those kinds of requests come through our main email address. So they come as a kind of a generic, and I think actually you did right there when I forgot to respond to you, which was great. So that's one way is to send in a request. We absolutely will do consultations and help student groups think through or university services or programs think through how they can become more accessible and what kinds of things that they might want to consider. Around the built environment, we're knowledgeable about lots of things and sometimes experts in nothing. So we're not architects and we can't design a facility for you, but we can help to point you in the right direction to figure out who you would need to talk to solve that problem that you've identified. And we can help you to identify which problems, you know, you might not have even noticed. So yes, the answer is yes, we'd be happy to.
Yay, cool. How about in mitigating stigmatization, how can everyone at UBC or even in general help mitigate or fight stigmatization? What would you say?
I think I would respond to that question in multiple layers. So one would be that we all have a responsibility to create a respectful and inclusive environment as a community at UBC. And so a part of that is an individual commitment to learning and understanding about the unique experiences and histories of all of the diverse members of our community. And so taking the opportunity to understand the impact of disability in some ways, but also to understand the impact of stigma and of stereotyping and of discrimination, and to not let those things get in the way of understanding the full range of ambitions and capacities that every individual, including people with disabilities, have. So that whole piece around your own personal knowledge, your own history, I think is really, or understanding is really important. The second, once you have that, is that sort of notion of see something, say something, right? Like to be, mm-hmm. A contributing member of our community and to speak out where you see the need for change or where you see somebody who needs support in order to provide a more respectful and inclusive environment, and to be a good ally for other members of the community. And then I think the other piece has to do with helping to identify and then address the systemic barriers, right? Like not like there's the, all the one-on-one piece, but the how do we as a community create a sense of urgency around addressing the barriers that people with disabilities face? And what role can we play as student leaders? What role can you play as, right, journalists? What role can an instructor play in identifying things that are happening in their faculty that might be less than inclusive or create a barrier for participation, possibly for students, but also for faculty and staff? And I think the last piece would be continuing to invite and to include people with disabilities in our community, right? Like we have, depending on the survey that you ask, about 20% of students with students will respond to say that they have, that they would identify as a person with a disability on any given survey. But those numbers are not the same for faculty and staff, right? We have a much lower number of faculty and staff with disabilities on our campus. And those folks are role models for, right, students who may be aspiring to work or live or learn in the fields that don't currently have role models. So I think, you know, increasing the number of people who identify as a person with a disability and can be a role model would be another place that I would focus some energy.
So it looks like it's 2:45 right now. So yes. If there's anything, is there anything else you want to let our listeners know?
You know, the only other thing I would say, and because I think it's easy to see UBC as a huge bureaucratic place, is that it goes back to the sort of the introductory question of who am I and why do I do this work, is I do think I've worked at UBC for 27 years now. And the reason that I have stayed at UBC and that I continue to love the work and look forward to going to work and being with my colleagues every day is I do think that UBC strives to be a great place, right? That our ambitions around inclusion and respect are more than just words. And that where we don't get it right is not because we were intentionally trying to get it wrong. It's because we